Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you to Paul this morning for putting you all up to speed, crash course in phylogeny. I thought that was a real, it was very well done. So I'm going to talk about, so I got interested in this, and you'll see as we go along, my perspective is that of a statistician and maybe a mathematician, definitely not of a biologist. And I got interested in this because I'm a bootstrap person. I wrote my thesis on bootstrap for the in a multivariate context, and it seemed to me that just to reduce the bootstrap to one number on the clade wasn't quite the right approach. And so I got interested in how do you represent the space of all trees, and in particular we're going to try and make confidence regions for trees and do statistics. So you've just seen where all the collections of trees come from. In fact, what one has very often is you can guess what the first letters are: Homo sapiens, gorilla, and so on. We coordinated very carefully on our data sets. So it's either that they're species on which you have different genes, or it might be that there are different populations. And so in a sense, it seems to me, and all the biologists can tell me that I'm wrong, that when DNA, when the molecular record started to become available, that it was believed that you could, if you chose the right method, you would just get a tree. And then, of course, that's wrong, and you just get a different tree for every gene, or you might even get several different trees, as we saw, with just one sequence. So the problem is, how do we put this together? How do we compute averages, compare all the different trees? And so in some sense, it's a decision problem. And in the decision problem, the way I put the context is, I have a parameter, which is an unknown parameter for me, which is going to be this semi-labeled binary tree. And for the time being, I'm going to stay in the rooted context. So compared to what was said this morning, this is quite similar. And so this is a case in which we want to find what the best estimator for this parameter that we can build is. And we also want to give a level of uncertainty, that is, if it was a real number that we were trying to estimate, some measurement or something, we'd give a confidence interval. We'd say, here's a 90%, 99% confidence interval for this parameter built with these data. And in this case, this is awkward. So this is sort of what drove Felsenstein when he started to put these bootstrap numbers on, because in the statistics world, when you were in a non-parametric situation and you didn't know how to build your distributions, you'd use the bootstrap for building confidence intervals. So that's just to situate that our space of parameters is the space of trees, and so what we want to try and build up is this idea of a confidence region in that tree, in that space. So here's an old example, Haeckel's phylogenetic tree. Now, in this case, some are borderline not being binary, but mostly it's binary. But I like this tree better, which comes from a paper by McFadden on horses, on the phylogeny of horses. And the reason why I like this picture is it incorporates at the same time this uncertainty in some of the branching. That is, at the same time, you have these wide areas where it's not quite sure, one isn't quite sure where the branching actually occurred. And this tree would support different branching orders. And so you have this idea that you'd like to put in all the possible trees that and narrow it down and see what areas needed to be narrowed down. So this is the biologist's intuitive approach to saying we're not sure about a lot of things simultaneously, so we should widen it out. And I'm going to try and address this in a more geometrical context. Oh, there's some data, random data, 12 species of primates, not quite a lot, not quite the same. I have a lot of macaque. And
but
come on. This is an old data set, so 1988, this is also mitochondrial data. This is I like the representation. It surprised me when I started working in this field, and I like the title of this whole program, and so I'll say a word about this. was, why did the biologists choose to code the pyrimidines and the purines with letters? Because in fact, what you have is ACGT. You can't see any structure. They're just categories. There are four categories. And when I was doing alignment, for instance, I like to color code. And what you do is, when you're color coding, you code A and G very, you know, orange and red, and then C and T, green and blue, and then you try and align those first. So you have these two, and then you have, which are very close, and then you just, you're making one difference between the two, and then you could try and broaden them. But that doesn't appear, and so that's one thing about the type of data and the way that you make it discrete. Which is interesting as a procedure. That is, it's interesting to me that there was this choice of letters in which there's part of the information which was lost. And I think that if some mathematicians or physicists had started off, they might have coded it differently, which would incorporate the fact that for these four bases, you could situate them in a three-dimensional space and represent their distances in various ways. But that's... So here are two trees that come up. They were built with parsimony in this case, and they differ only in one area, which is this. On the one hand, we have Homo sapiens here, and on the other hand, we have the gorilla, which is apart. So those two trees are what they come out as. The algorithm actually gives two shortest trees. That is. Two trees that obey the maximum parsimony, and you'd like to know how you should represent that. One of the questions, and the way I see the bootstrap in this context is, as Paul said this morning, in some sense you can imagine we have the space of all trees and that we're projecting onto it from the data in such a way as here, for instance, here we would have our measurements. And maybe the true tree was here, and that the true data, if we had perfect data, it would have looked like this. And then, on the other hand, you want to try and find out how sure you are that your tree is the right tree. So in some sense, what the bootstrap does is you do a perturbation analysis, and what you're trying to find out really is, how close am I to the boundary? That is, how close am I to changing to a different tree? And in this first paper I wrote about the subject with Brad Efron, who's actually the inventor of the bootstrap in statistics, we found that some of the criteria, some of the things that come into play in seeing whether the bootstrap functions properly or not, have to do with the curvature of the regions, of the boundaries between the regions, and the number of neighboring regions. And so in that paper we had this picture, which was an intuitive picture of what we were after. And there were other people who worked on that around the same time. I know that Zarki and Lee published a simulation paper in which they were asking, given a tree, how many neighbors does it have? How many neighboring regions are there? And that a tree which had a lot of neighboring regions, you could expect the bootstrap to be quite pessimistic because you have to split up the 100% between all those.
Each region is a different tree?
Yeah, each region represents a different tree.
Just the slightest variation will be
colored the same way. Right. They all have slight variations. And that's the whole point of what I was trying to see what was of interest. In fact, what's of interest in some sense from a mathematical point of view is the estimation procedure continuous? And in order to be able to define this notion of continuous, you have to define the geometry, define the notion of a neighborhood. So,
but here you mean topological changes.
Yeah. Well,
different regions are different topologies, or?
Right. And in fact, what we would like to have would be a representation in which if I was at absolute center of a region, I'm very safe and I'm very sure of my tree. And if I'm close to a boundary, it would mean that I'm much less sure of my tree. So I'd like a representation of all trees such that the true trees that with large inner edges, which aren't close to being star-like, are in the center of the region. And I'd like to find out a way of representing the trees, the space of all trees, in that way. So that's what I'm going to build up to. Okay. So So this also has an effect in the way you do the statistics, because in fact, when you have a problem of multiple testing, it's been shown that it's better addressed by doing the multivariate problem completely than by using Bonferroni or things like that, which are very pessimistic, which you lose a lot of information in the data. So for instance, I'll make a little picture just to say what I mean here. I'm just, suppose that you were doing a bivariate parameter. So suppose I had two variables that I was interested in. And you have various measurements of them. So I have lots. So in this case, this might be the 100 simulations of the different bootstrap trees. And in some sense, one method would be to say, well, I know the distribution. I know the parametric distribution of the trees. And so I will have regions like this. And then I'll have a method, so they would be ellipsoid if it was normal, multivariate normal, for instance. And I have a method for building up a confidence region in two dimensions. But if it was non-parametric, if I don't have ahead of time a parametric model that I can build up, then in this case, for instance, you could decide to make the convex hull of the points. And then you could decide also that you wanted to, that's a lousy convex hull. And here. And then the non-parametric version of the ellipsoids would be to say I take the second peel and maybe it contains 90% of the points. So at the same time, I have a confidence region which has all the multivariate structure in it, instead of seeing, which in the Bonferroni type thing, one does, you're making rectangles essentially, and you're building it down by rectangles. So if you can keep as close to the data as possible, it's better, and that's why also this geometrical representation would be useful. And so this is a little bootstrap example. Let's see.
So you've got continuous axes on there.
I'll come to that. For me, for the time being, I'm going to suppose that the tree is just the tree, the branching order. I don't call it the topology because I use topology somewhere else. So I don't call it the topology. I call it the branching order. But for me, this tree B C A is the same as the tree, you know, with a very long. You know, this is the same tree for the time being.
So that's
same branching order, but different.
I'm just wondering what the axes are on your
track. But that's the whole. That's where I'm going. Right. I have to build it up. Right. Yeah. Right.
Suppose you have a radiation in nature.
Yeah.
Radiation happens. So a lot of branching points close in time.
Right.
So then, sort of, your true tree would be very close.
Yeah.
A boundary of one of your
it will become part of the picture. Right, it's okay. I'm going to take those as the extreme points. So also I wanted to say that this is a useful picture for what's going on in microarray world where people are using clustering. And the question in the microarrays is, do all the clustering trees, are they on a path? That's one of the questions. So this space of all trees also works for clustering, any kind of clustering trees, so I'm not going to talk about that. So here we have two binary trees, and there are other parameterizations of tree space, and in particular, the Monte Carlo Markov chain that Paul talked about this morning, these two authors did that for the Bayesian framework. And so one of the questions also, the people who don't have a frequentist approach of 90% for a confidence interval or confidence region, they have the Bayesian approach, which is to say, what is the posterior probability of a region? So they have probability they want to be able to compute probabilities on meaningful sets. So they have exactly the same problem. So whether you're a Bayesian or a frequentist, you actually need this geometry. So the first representation that I tried to make, I did with Percy Diaconis, and it had to do, we thought we held a very useful representation of trees, which in fact, in practice, when you're doing simulations is quite useful, and the biologists sort of rejected it. But I will give it to you because it does have certain of the components which are useful, and since you're going to be doing all kinds of things about trees. And so this is a representation in which to each tree, and as I said, binary pattern, I'm going to associate, in fact, couples of siblings. So in this case, these matchings, for me, they're all the same matching. So it's 1, 4, I said, 2, 5, 3, 6. So what is a matching? A matching is, here I have a matching on 6 labels, and it's 3 pairs of couples. So for me, this is the same matching as 4, 1, 6, 3, 2, 5. So in fact, I don't care whether I've switched within a couple, and I don't care about the situation of the couples.
But that's not binary tree.
No, but there's a bijection between that. So I took a class in combinatorics between, 1992, and Richard Stanley said how many of these things there were. It turns out they're exactly the same if you do some move as trees. So I'm going to show you. For this, you would have, it would be a tree on 4 leaves. And so the way you would build it would be you have 1 and 4. Okay. And then next available label is 5. And then 5 goes with 2, so it's a sibling pair. The next available label is 6. So 6 and 3 is a sibling pair. The definition for me of a sibling pair is just that they have the same parent. Okay?
What's an available label?
So I'll explain that. When I have a tree to begin with, so let me take this tree. So 2, 4, 3. So this is the usual rooted binary tree, okay? And usually the inner nodes don't have labels. On the other hand, these do have labels. And I'm going to make a rule. It doesn't matter. The bijection can be built up with any rule, but I'm going to make one. And my rule will be I will give the labels, so the only available labels here are 5 and 6, because they're the inner nodes which don't have labels. And I'm going to give the next available label to the sibling pair with the smallest child. So that's my rule. So in this case, I'm going to call this 5 and this 6. So to this tree, I can associate the matching 1, 3, 2, 4, 5, 6. And this bijection is quite useful in ways for doing, for instance, if you want to enumerate all trees with small changes, there's what we call a gray code or a Hamiltonian path on all trees going through this matching representation. It's also very useful for doing random walk type techniques. It mixes quite fast. And so to say, how would you do a random walk on trees this way? You take the matching, and you take 2 pairs at random. So I'm going to take maybe this one and this one. So from there, I'm going to go to 1, 3, 5, 6. So I have these 2 pairs. Within these 2 pairs, I'm going to switch one of these with 3. So I have 2 choices, and I can do it with probability 1/2. And so I will go to, say, 1, 5, 2, 4, and then 3, 6. So that's a move, in some sense, and I can use that in order to do all the simulated annealing type techniques. Or it's actually, if I have time later on, we can analyze it in exactly the same way as you can for the Bernoulli-Laplace model, and it has to do with the fact that the The matchings is the quotient of two groups which form a Gell-Phong pair.
So earlier you said it doesn't matter, for example, 1425 is the same as 1452. 1425 is the same as 1452.
Right.
And the way you build the tree, is it the same?
Yes, it is. It has to do with this property that that Paul said this morning about, it's a very pretty image, but it's like a mobile. You have to define your rule for labeling once and for all. That is, if you change your rule for giving the inside labels, you can get some different. You just have to believe me about that rule. That rule works. It makes a bijection. Yeah.
Does that algorithm you just gave correspond to pruning branches and swapping them, or?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't do anything that biologists like. So it's been abandoned to oblivion, except by people who work on the actual theory. I have a paper coming out with Diaconis, because you can actually analyze how many moves of that type, and it's a half n log n plus constant n of these walks, of these random moves to get random. So there is no, you know, everybody who's doing the Metropolis Hastings and all these methods, there is no theory. There's no theory about how long you have to mix. So how long do you have to go on? So this is the first one. Unfortunately, it's a pretty useless one, because what it does is it hits uniform distribution on all trees. Now, that's not what you're doing when you're doing random walk on tree space. Usually, you're trying to optimize some criteria. But at least it's a baseline that you could use in comparison type techniques. So that was a first representation, in some sense, of trees in some geometry, and the way you could build a geometry around that. I'm not going to give you the group theory. There is this picture represents all 15 matchings, or all 15 trees on four leaves. And I've joined two of the trees by an edge if I can get from one to the other with one of these moves, okay? So if you can get from one to the other. So it's one geometrical representation in some sense, and I was thinking maybe I could take the polytope of which these trees were the extreme points and then take their dual in order to get this idea that I wanted to have the center of a face to be the tree, and then as we get closer to the boundary. Unfortunately, this isn't embeddable in Euclidean space of low dimension, and so it didn't give a very useful representation. It did, in some sense, lead us to the right one, but it didn't give the representation. I have another picture, but I seem to have erased it. It didn't give a representation which was satisfactory, although there is something about this idea of filling it in. If I filled all this in, I could say if I got three or four trees as my result, I could see whether they were close in the number of edges. But this is actually a very dense graph, so it's quite disappointing matching.
So what you're basically looking for is a metric.
Well, yeah, a geometry, yeah, a metric between trees.
Between trees.
A notion of neighborhood. Right. Absolutely. So I was inspired then from work that was been done on probability.
I'm still trying to understand. You're interested in a metric in order to generate neighborhoods of tree space or whatever, but you would want this ideally to be independent of your move set, you know, in terms of the fact that you don't want the neighborhood of trees of how different trees are to be defined by how you go from one tree to another.
Well,
it seems like very difficult.
Now, in some sense, what I'd like is to have at the same time to have a tree at the center of a region, defined maybe with lots of boundaries, I don't know, like this. And the idea would be that in some sense, it would be acceptable to the biologist that this tree and this tree are neighbors. They share a boundary. So they are as close as two trees could be without being the same, in some sense, if they're neighbors. you'd like this notion of neighbor, so that if I had two trees here, which are on this, they would be very similar. So that's one thing. The other thing I'd like to be able to represent at the same time is the fact that if I'm in the center of the region, I'm as safe as I can in my believing that that's the right tree. Okay? So that's what...
But in the second sense, you would want it to be... The metric that you would want to use is where do you move when you add, for instance, randomness, Poisson distribution noise, and things like that,
Right.
What is it about nearest neighbor interchange that doesn't satisfy this criteria?
I'm getting to it. That's okay. What I'm going to do. It does, and that's the one I choose.
Okay.
The matching one, basically what happened was I came up with the matching, also it's wonderful because you can code up all the trees in matrices, and it just works wonderfully on the computer, and every time I talk to a biologist, they say, get out of here, we want nearest neighbor interchange distances. Basically, that's their idea of neighborhood was that one. So yes, that's right. No, I was just going to say, as a statistician, I'm also trying to build up some kind of probability model on the space of trees, and this is called Mallow's model, but it's very close to what the physicists know, in the sense that you have, it's the case that for any tree in this case, it's something which was built up to begin with for permutations, and it relates to, permutation data, which is hard to represent as well, is that if you could just define a distance between a tree, tau, and a central tree, tau zero, and you had some idea of a concentration parameter, this is a satisfactory model if you have a lot of symmetry in your data. So Mallow's model was quite, an inspiration. It's an exponential family in which you need a central tree, and it allows generalization to the Bayesian context. So this was even more of a justification of saying, really, what I'm after, the two components of my geometry, in some sense, will be the distance between two trees and the idea of a central tree. So that would come up all the time. It comes up all the time. Okay, so distances and centroids, I'll say, are essential.
And P of two is probability?
It's the probability distribution, right, some measure for the tree, right. And so this is one of the polytopes that I thought would be helpful, and this is called the permutor associahedron, and this is a zonotope in which here you have, it's not the trees, because here you have 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, the group 3, 4 is treated as different as the group 1, 2, 4, 3. So we have difference here. So we'd have to do identifications, and we'd also have to do identifications which go back, which cut back. So it's not such a useful representation. So what we're going to do is really build up from scratch a representation. So we want a neighborhood relationship, and we want the trees to sit in the center of our regions. Okay, so back to the rotation moves. This is the neighborhood. This is the idea of being a neighbor, it's a nearest neighbor interchange. The combinatorists call it the rotation moves. And I'm going to stay with rooted trees. So for me, to go from that the tree 1, 2, 3, 4 to the tree 1, 2, 3, 4 like that, I need one rotation move. I need to make one edge disappear and one edge grow. So first of all, you make 3, 4, this edge disappear, and then you make a different edge grow. Okay? So that's the idea that you, as you're going to be moving towards a boundary and moving away from the boundary. So already you can see that what we have at the boundary here would in fact be this. This is a degenerate case, 1, 2, and then we have 3, 4 at the root. So on the boundary, we have a degeneracy, and within the faces, we have the actual trees. Okay, so I'm going to take the simplest case of three leaves. So if you take three leaves, what does the space of all tree on three leaves look like? Well, I take these three, 1, 2, 3, so 1 an outlier, 3 an outlier, 2 an outlier. Those are my three essential points here. 1, 2, 3. And as this inside edge here, its length in some sense is represented as being along this segment. Because as we move along here, we get closer and closer to the star tree, so we can imagine making it smaller. Now, I don't want you to think that I started off at the beginning with a tree with edge lengths. I didn't. I'm starting off with a tree which is just the branching structure and the idea that I'd like to fill in the space so I have this neighborhood relationship. Now, that on top of this, there's actually a biological meaning to branch lengths is important, but it's not something I start off with. It's just the idea that I want this neighborhood relationship. So that's for three trees, and the boundary is just a point. Now, if I go to four leaves, and I put in the quadrant, at the origin, I'll have the star tree with zero and zero. And if I take the full tree is on the edge of the quadrant here. So this is one and one. And then you have the intermediary ones. Here, I have that edge. So we have one degeneracy. I only have one full edge. And here I have the other one. So I know in this case, for instance, that four is an outgroup here. So this is the representation that I'm going to use for the trees. And it's built, I'm going to build up a cube complex of all these different trees, which are going to be all sharing little boundaries. Okay, so if you look at the case for four leaves, what did I have? I had four leaves and I have two inside edges. You always have, you know, if you have n leaves, you're going to have n minus two inner nodes. So your representation for your tree will be a cube of size n minus two. Okay? So then you'll have these boundaries, which will be the boundaries where you'll have degeneracy, which won't be real trees. No interior edges. So this is how they articulate. So this is one case in which you can see, you know, that you have a segment, which is the boundary between those three trees. So those three trees share something. And you can see, in fact, this is a partial image of tree space. And then if you want to find out the number of regions, you have to fill it in further. That is, in my picture here, I only built, you know, part of the picture. So I have the origin there, and then here I'll have these other two flaps, which are also neighbors. And why am I having such a hard time drawing this? It's because it's not embeddable. That is, I can't represent this in three dimensions nicely, because I'm going to have some identifications which will occur, which will make it so that, you know, this has to go back. But just to give you an idea how many neighbors, you know, the origin, the star tree, is going to be the tree that has the most neighbors. It's a neighbor to all the trees. Okay? So you'll see that depending on which edges, whether neighboring edges are small or not, you'd see the neighborhoods are going to be different. So one thing to remark, which is actually very useful in practice, because you don't have to do this exercise, in fact, in very high dimensional space, is that although here these are all trees with four leaves, I have, it's embedded in it, is the representation that I had before, this, of the space of trees on three leaves. So this is the space of tree on three leaves, which is here, which is embedded there. Yes?
If you manage to embed it in some high-dimensional space, is it just one-to-one correspondence, or some points in this space you should identify? It's the same if you embed it, let's say, for liquid crystals, you embed it, the director on map it on the sphere, and two polar regions on this sphere you should identify.
Mm-hmm.
So you should do the same in this
three-dimensional. Right.
There are certain regions
which
are
So
topology will be non-trivial.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
So it's non-Euclidean.
Right. Right. And that's the whole difficulty. It's been a big difficulty when the biologists talk, for instance, about this idea of local maxima and their landscape of trees, and it goes up and goes down. There hasn't been a representation of this because, in fact, you know, what looks like neighboring points, depending on how you represent it, it looks as if they're far apart. And if you make on this, often it's connected. But depending on the projection you've taken, it's not connected. And I guess you can see here, for instance, with this lower dimensional embedding of the property, that in fact, if trees agree on everything except one inner edge, you can just project it down. It doesn't matter. We'll only be looking at the parts where they differ. So something, if you, even if you started off with 50 species, if they agreed on 47, you'll be down to a representation which you could actually make usefully, because you have this embedding property. And so if they share everything except one thing, you can project it down to this one. If they share everything except two things, then you have this kind of representation. So you have this embedding property. The next thing that we used in order to find the properties of the space is what's called the link of the origin. And that is, in fact, that we look at this, all the points such that the sum of the coordinates is equal to 1. So in this case, I'd get this, I get this. So let me use color. So here, here, here. That's what's called the link of the origin. And so the link of the origin in this case is a well-known graph. It's called the Peterson graph. And it has enough properties. So here, I extended a little my quadrant, and so just to show you, you know, the first part of the link of the origin, and you can see, you know, what the problem is going to be, these little connections, which are triplets in the point. So that's the Peterson graph. That's the graph of the link of the origin. And this is the case for four leaves. This is what it looks like. But you can choose your representation, but that's what this looks like. And then you can, in this way, by making the graph, you're able to see these connecting properties, what happens. So why are we interested? I mean, what is it that, you know, what's driven this geometry? Why do we want to find out the properties? Well, it is the fact that this space, because of, we can prove things about the link of the origin, has the property that it has non-positive curvature. And because of the properties of the link of the origin, and I won't go into the details, we can prove that the space of all trees on n leaves, Tn, is what's called a cat zero space. Now, that's just a term, which means, in fact, that triangles are thin. So if I go to this, it's a very nice, so cat zero is something which was worked on by a lot of people. There's a very nice book now out by Brightson and Haeflinger, which is very understandable, which explains all the properties of this. It has to do with geometric group theory. But the main property, if you're a biologist, to go away with is in cat zero space, triangles are thin. So it means, what does that mean by triangles are thin? It means in particular, if you have a way in which you're averaging, and this comes up when you're doing consensuses or things like that. So if you're averaging, say I'm averaging by taking the average of two or comparing two and then comparing two, and comparing two, and then I take this. Your averaging process goes very fast. It goes faster than if you were in a Euclidean space and doing such a thing. Okay, so this geometric property allows you to go faster, these thin triangles. And it's something which has appeared empirically quite a bit in the literature. In the phylogenetic literature, it's people like Gasquel and Berry have a paper in which they noticed that if they did, instead of using just the first tree as an estimator in cases when they knew the result by simulation, if they used the bootstrap and took the consensus tree of the bootstrap, they got a much better tree by various criteria that they fixed for themselves. And so the idea was that here, by taking averages, because the space has this non-positive curvature, you're doing much better than you ought to. And it has to do with this geometric structure, which is not Euclidean. So a lot of our Euclidean intuitions sort of fall through for this space.
So when you're talking about the sampling, this is sort of actually looking at the space of trees and
right.
in a way that doesn't involve this representation at all, or does it? In other words, I'm just wondering, is this result representation dependent only for this particular representation?
No. I mean, I started off with trees. So it will depend on your various ways of building geodesics and averages, you know, what your curvature will be. But in general, no. This is a fact about the space of all trees. So the consequence of it being a cat zero space, I can understand that that's not so interesting to a lot of you, but it does have theoretical consequences which make it quite useful. You can define centroids. This negative curvature allows you to do this process of, you know, building the geodesic. You can always build a geodesic between two trees, and you can always define the centroid of two trees as the halfway point between on the geodesic between the two trees. And you can also always define, when I said these convex hulls, we can always define those convex hulls, so you can always find the points which are the deepest in the convex hull. And, yeah?
Sorry to interrupt, but if you do that, what does that mean in terms of, I've got this tree, I've got this tree, and you just said take their geodesic, and
right.
now I'm going to have some other tree that's their geodesic?
In the tree space.
I'm a little bit lost. What does that mean?
So take the geodesic means you take your tree space and you walk like an ant on the tree space. So I'm just going to show you a simple example. So locally, all the distances are ordinary Euclidean distances and paths between points. So if we're talking about two trees who are in the same quadrant with the same branching pattern, their distance is just going to be the ordinary distance between two trees who have different branch lengths. So this, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, sorry. Okay. So these two trees have the same branching pattern, and you just look at the distance, the ordinary Euclidean distance, which would be given by taking the sums of the squares of the distances of the inner nodes. Okay, so that's okay. You know how to do that. The next step is, if you have two trees which belong to a different quadrant, so they have different branching patterns, one of two things can occur. Either, like in this case, the shortest path, and now imagine yourself, you're an ant, and you want to go from this point, but you have to stay in the quadrants. So it'll be something like that. That's the geodesic. Okay? Yes?
So just to give an example, let's say, and we can do this without branch length being involved at all.
Yes.
Right? Now, if I take two trees, so for example, if I just want to take two that have what we would call a nearest neighbor interchange.
Yeah.
Right, and there's no branch lengths involved.
No.
The geodesic then is going to be on that. It's going to be the trifurcation point, or is it going to be
yes.
something else?
No, it's going to be the trifurcation point. Because it'll be exactly on here. Right?
Right. So I'm stuck with, if I have, for example, there's three possibilities there if you do a nearest neighbor interchange. But if I know that there's only two of them, and I have 50%, percent probability, I'm still stuck with the intermediate, which...
Sorry, I lost you.
Sorry, you have no sense of visualizing the fact that two trees are... There's two of the possibilities have much more weight on them than the other. You see what I mean? You're closing in on the center there.
So if you're looking at trees which are one nearest neighbor interchange,
yes,
away...
Exactly.
And so you can sort of summarize it down to this one edge, right? I mean, even if it's not on three leaves, it's the equivalent of this situation.
Yes.
Okay, so you have this guy. Then you have two effectively, you have two possibilities, right? But you know, if you have two trees, you know which one we're talking about. Either it's the one out here with one, you know, one. I'm just projecting it down.
Yes.
And or the other possibility is the one which has two outside. No, what did I do? Cheated. Okay. Sorry. So to go from here, you have to, the geodesic is the same. The distance is the same from here to this one as from here to that one. Okay? And so the problems arise, so just to say more towards what I'm going, is that it's to give a geometric representation of what the consensus methods, you know, the different consensus methods have different rules. What you'd like to find out is what is their geometric meaning.
Question, is there always a unique geodesic in this representation?
Yes. There's a unique geodesic, right. And if your trees are incompatible, you know, if there is a lot of, most of the paths will go through the origin. You'll have to go through the star tree a lot of the time. Okay, so you all the edges go down to the star tree, and then you build all the other ones up.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, so I don't know what time it is. I'm just going to keep...
10 to.
Okay. So here is just a representation a little further in... What we're trying to do now, for instance, is look at, if you can represent all the trees, you'd like to be able to project it down and see if there's a pathway that is a tree trajectory, or if you have the idea of a confidence region, you'd like to be able to say that you can project it down if they all have the same, if all the trees have the same structure, except for a few parts, you could project it down in this three-dimensional space and hopefully find what the trajectories look like. So the abstract mathematics has helped somewhat, and the notion, for instance, of averages of trees is an important one. And then what I haven't addressed here, which probably, you know, you'll arrive at next in the end of the third week, is the problem that, in fact, one of the main questions also that people want to ask is, I forced the data to be tree-like. So how close, in fact, were the data to a tree? And you could picture this a little by saying, well, my data points, you know, is in a different space, and I'm projecting down. And there is a problem, one of the questions which arise, which is, if I'm here, and it's the same distance to project down from here as it is to project down to there, you know, am I going to get my confidence regions disconnected? So those are all questions which pertain to this representation. For instance, you could imagine making the likelihood contours and asking yourself, am I going to get my likelihood contours look like this, disconnected like that, or am I necessarily going to only have contours, you know, which are nicely connected through a frontier or something like that? And one of the things that you do get is the contours, of course, you know ahead of time they're going to have leaves. They'll have leaves in them. So even if it's like in this situation, in fact, you don't see what's happening at the back. But what I found up to now is you get this situation in which you have like that, and then the other leaf is there. So it looks, you know, you might get something like that for the likelihood contour. The likelihood contour, you know, locally you get this ellipsoidal behavior often. So that's one of the things. And I could talk about several other things. I have transparent overheads for several other things or questions, if you want to. This was the part I prepared on the computer is there. I do have something that I wanted to say, which has to do with There's an argument among biologists. It's completely orthogonal to what I just said about geometry, but it does have to do a lot with this context. There's an argument in the world of biology between the people who use maximum likelihood and the people who use parsimony. And from a statistician's point of view, we're much more pragmatic and we're used to using three paradigms, which are either a parametric paradigm, in which your parameter space, and this is why I'm so interested in parameter space in general, is usually RP, where P is defined ahead of time, finite. And that's important. The Bayesian paradigm starts off, in fact, the parameter have themselves distributions. And so you have various collections of distributions of the parameters. And I won't go into details, but that's the generalization. And then the non-parametric paradigm is that, in fact, you don't know what the parameters are before you see the data. So it's just an infinite dimensional space. And it's been shown by some mathematicians from New Zealand that in the case when you do maximum likelihood, that you allow yourself, you allow your branch lengths to increase. You allow your branch lengths to have different mutation parameters. So you add parameters to your model. That is, instead of having a fixed molecular clock, you allow certain branches to have different. So if you increase the number of parameters so much so that, in fact, you have, in some sense, more parameters to estimate than the amount of information in your data, then maximum likelihood and parsimony give the same result. And for us, that's completely coherent with all the other descriptions in the parametric, in the statistical world. That is, it's very often the case that the parametric methods and the non-parametric methods meet. So you have a spectra of methods, in some sense, from the parametric with a fixed number of parameters to the non-parametric, and they meet where the data is, where you don't have enough data to estimate all the parameters. And so there's not this tension, this argument, this is the right way, this is the wrong way, because it just depends on how much information you think you have. And if you have a lot of information, then you can use a very, you know, detailed parametric method. And if you don't have very much information, you use a non-parametric method. And, you know, it's the same in, if you take the simplest possible case possibly to think about, because it's true that the tree case is extremely complex because it has all these different components, is to think about the various methods for doing regression. And it might be that you start off with a model. I'd say, you know, the equivalent of a Duke's contour model would be to do a straight line here and say you have AX plus B with A and B your two parameters. Then you might have two parameter model, and in this case, you know, quadratic form, and that would also be an extra parameter. And that's the equivalent of a quadratic. Now, if you just say, I want to do smoothing, and that's the equivalent of doing parsimony, and you're not saying ahead of time, you know, what the number of parameters you need, because you don't know, you know, you might get something which is sort of like this. You don't know how many parameters you'll need to fit it until you've seen the data. But there's not this tension about, it just depends on the validity of the biological data, which allows you to say, I know this parameter, I know this parameter, and so on. So we don't have, and so the person who proved, people who worked on this, Tuffy and Steele, have a very nice paper about, in some sense, the equivalence between non-parametric and parametric approaches, and how, you know, it's the amount of information which is essential to that. And so, of course, you can ask then, if given this geometric representation of tree space, you know, how many parameters or how much information is necessary from a set of sequences given the number of leaves. The essential question is, you know, how much how many parameters do I need in order to estimate with such and such of certainty, or the, you know, with certain probability, my region where my I'm sure with that probability that my tree resides. But that depends, of course, on the number of species and the amount of information. And that's why I thought that I really liked the title of the workshop, because I do think it's this tension between information, amount of information present, is an interesting one.
There's a sweet spot between how many parameters you have and how much information you have.
Sorry?
There's an optimal number of parameters given the data you have.
But you don't know it until you've seen the data.
Right.
That's why, basically, the approach is much more non-parametric than it is parametric. Mm-hmm. So you have very good concordance in the data. You can expect to have a very a model which is quite low in number of parameters.
So I'm going to try and estimate a bunch of models with variable number of parameters. A large data set, quite how much information goes in there. Is there people developed the whole literature on
Aikaiki.
How many parameters?
Aikaiki. Aikaiki.
Aikaiki.
I wasn't kidding, that's the name. He's a Japanese guy. And Aikaiki. Is the Aikaiki information criteria, because we have this problem all the time in statistics, because in some sense you have to cost yourself for the number of parameters that you put in the model. Of course, you will do extremely well. If I allow you unlimited non-parametric model, then the best way to fit these points is to do this. Okay, we all agree. It's practically useless for prediction, for evaluation purposes, and so on. So you've sinned by over parameterizing your problem, and this is what happens a lot in non-parametrics, and that's why what you put in is a cost function. For instance, here the cost function will involve smoothness, and so this tension between the amount of information and the amount of parameters, there are various ways, but there's what's called Aikaiki's criteria. It's one of them. Yeah.
I have two comments. One relates to before, which is, in my mind, all parameters are not created equal, which is a big problem. And then that Aikaiki in particular is nice, but I mean, I sometimes call it the arbitrary information criterion, because it does seem to be, I mean, it's nice, you want something, and it's nice to have something, and you feel good about it. But
No, I don't say that, I mean, you'd have to study it pretty carefully in the phylogenetic context, which I haven't. I mean, it's a completely, as you're right, all parameters are not created equal, and if you have a parameter, which in this case a tree, which can take on 2n minus 5 double factorial possible values before you get started, you know, that's before you even put in the branch lengths. That's a very, very rich parametrization, right? You're allowing yourself an awful lot of degrees of freedom. So you better have a lot of data if you're going to choose, you know, with in there. Now I'm taking the worst case, but
are those real degrees of freedom? I mean,
well, I'd say no, because when you come in and you say, "I know that this is an outgroup," you've already set yourself in a whole exponentially lower dimension space than to start with. Yeah.
Can we go back to the diagram of the contours that you
yes.
saw, right? And so my question is, if you've got two of these separate planes which are meeting, the planes representing different topologies, can you ever have the situation where you have two sets of
we're
two
talking
peaks? So,
yeah.
Right. So
I don't know.
That I can understand the way you've drawn it there. Then the question is, can you ever have two isolated maxima?
Yes, well, that's what I'm worried about, and it's not something I know anything about. That is, I haven't proved anything about this, because I only talked to you about the space of trees. I didn't talk at all about the next step I said I wanted to look at the space of trees because I wanted to give a notion of neighborhood so I could talk about continuity of the estimation process. So in fact, what you want to study really is a function which goes from the data, your sequences, even before there are lines in some sense, to this space. And you might be in a situation where you have two you know, you have a point which is projected equally well here or here, and they're disconnected. So you could expect that the contours would be isolated.
Yeah. I can tell you one thing, that the that it's known that the optima can be isolated. In other words, that if you have, if you look at the, which, what's the optimum on this plane and the optimum on this plane, that they're not at
that implies that you do have isolated regions here.
Oh, I just think that that's...
What about the Bayesian priors? Well, in other words, what can you do in terms of this model?
Well, the simplest one, of course, is to take the Mallow's model type. It's the most symmetric one as your prior. It is very symmetric. You know, it means that every tree which is at an equal distance from your central tree, probably from your best estimator in some sense, is equally likely.
So in other words, it sort of says the highest prior is star phylogeny, basically.
No. It puts the prior on a whole region of space, but it just doesn't say, it's just very symmetrical. I didn't say that T0 had to be the origin, the star tree. I expect you to take as T0 your estimator. If you use a Bayesian method, you'll get a Bayesian estimator. So I expect that if that was your best estimate, you'll use this, and then you'll have some notion of, you know, you'll have, if I make it big enough, this will contain, it might contain the origin, and it'll contain, you know, lots of other things as well. It might contain other trees. So that's one method of putting a Bayesian. But knowing the geometry in some sense is sort of necessary, because the, I won't talk to you about the properties of consistency, but the problem of consistency in this, with this geometry, is extremely hard to formalize, because what happens at the origin is that at the star tree, you have that many neighboring cubes. So as n increases, grows horrendously. So you have this blow-up phenomena. So all the consistency results often have to do with things where you have to leave out that, because of the blow-up at the origin.
Are there other ways of defining the nearest neighbor trees? Just for example, you could just say you have two nodes which collide, and then you see.
There are lots of ways of, it's all the literature on defining distances between trees. There are lots of ways of defining distances between trees, and they all, in some sense, there are methods which have to do with each inner edge defines a split. And so you could define, you know, the split, your edge defines this, and so you have whatever happens down here, and then you have an edge, and then you have whatever happens down here. And if this, there are various distances which have to do with the partition here, which are called partition-based distances. So there is lots and lots. I mean, Day has a paper. I can think of several people. Critchlow has a paper. Which reviews these. There are lots of different methods of. It's just that I kept as close as I could to nearest neighbor interchange, because it really did seem that that's the one that the biologists like best.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, one of the reasons why I can imagine biologists would like this is a belief that things are sort of conservative when you add noise. That way, when you add noise, the way the trees changes. In their view, the prejudices correspond to nearest neighbor joining.
Right.
But Mike Steele says that that's not true. You know, that you could add some data to it, and all of a sudden you get a completely different tree topology, and it's not that things tend to be nice and local in terms of moving around in neighbor joining space.
That's above. That's the problem with the data.
That's right.
That's not the problem with this. This is the right notion of neighborhood for tree space. It's just the problem of what we just said, that the function that goes from the data to here, okay, might not be continuous. So you might want to make it so it is, or cost yourself when it isn't. Yeah.
Is there a good way in there to figure out if you have mixed data? So for example, I was looking at a problem with recombination and sequences that appear to have recombined, and one thing that's interesting about that is when you do have mixed data like that, you get this kind of wacky data that he's talking about, that you're suddenly jumping between wildly different trees, none of them necessarily the right answer for one set data set over the other.
I only know how to put that into context of the trees. That is, for one set of data, you're going to get one tree, and it might be that you're very sure of that tree. That is, that data is good data for you. So you make a very small, you know, and a lot of weight would be put on this point, and then you might have very strange data for you, which is very unsure or anything like that. So here you would put a whole distribution on a very wide area, and so in some sense, then from there to there, you could build a compromise, which the best way of doing it would be in a Bayesian framework, which would be the posterior distribution of these two combined. But I'm already talking in tree space, because what you do with your data, you know, when you treat it differently, I don't know. I haven't addressed that.
Okay, it's time to cut these. Thanks very much.